considering it. George began to see that if he didn't pull the counterpane up over Grandma's face, he couldn't claim to have done everything right, and thus Buddy would have a leg, no matter how shaky, to stand on. Now he saw himself telling the spooky story of Grandma's death at the campery fire before Taps, just getting to the comforting conclusion where Mom's headlights swept into the driveway, the reappearance of the grown-up, both reestablishing and reconfirming the concept of order. And suddenly, from the shadows, a dark figure arises, and a pine knot in the fire explodes, and George can see its Buddy there in the shadows saying, "If you was so brave, Chicken Guts, how come you didn't dare to cover up her face?" George stood up, reminding himself that Grandma was out of it, that Grandma was wasted, that Grandma was laying chilly. He could put her hand back in bed, stuff a tea bag up her nose, put on earphones playing Chuck Berry full blast, etc., etc., and none of it would put a buzz under Grandma, because that was what being dead was about. Nobody could put a buzz under a dead person. A dead person was the ultimate laid-back cool, and the rest of it was just dreams. Ineluctable and apocalyptic and feverish dreams about closet doors swinging open in the dead mouth of midnight. Just dreams about moonlight skating a delirious blue on the bones of disinterred skeletons. Just, he whispered, "Stop it, can't you? Stop being so gross." He steeled himself. He was going to go in there and pull the coverlet up over her face and take away Buddy's last leg to stand on. He would administer the few simple rituals of Grandma's death perfectly. He would cover her face, and then, his face lit at the symbolism of this, he would put away her unused tea bag and her unused cup. Yes. He went in. Each step a conscious act. Grandma's room was dark, her body a vague hump in the bed, and he fumbled madly for the light switch, not finding it for what seemed to be an eternity. At last it clicked up, flooding the room with low yellow light from the cut glass fixture overhead. Grandma lay there, hand dangling, mouth open. George regarded her, dimly aware that little pearls of sweat now clung to his forehead, and wondered if his responsibility in the matter could possibly extend to picking up that cooling hand and putting it back in bed with the rest of Grandma. He decided it did not. Her hand could have fallen out of bed any old time. That was too much. He couldn't touch her. Everything else, but not that. Slowly, as if moving through some thick fluid instead of air, George approached Grandma. He stood over her, looking down. Grandma was yellow. Part of it was the light, filtered through the old fixture. But not all. Breathing through his mouth, his breath rasping audibly, George grasped the coverlet and pulled it up over Grandma's face. He let go of it, and it slipped just a little, revealing her hairline and the yellow-creased parchment of her brow. Steeling himself, he grasped it again, keeping his hands far to one side and the other of her head so he wouldn't have to touch her, even through the cloth, and pulled it up again. This time it stayed. It was satisfactory. Some of the fear went out of George. He had buried her. Yes, that was why you covered the dead person up, and why it was right. It was like burying them. It was a statement. He looked at the hand dangling down, unburied, and discovered now that he could touch it. He could tuck it under and bury it with the rest of Grandma. He bent, grasped the cool hand, and lifted it. The hand twisted in his and clutched his wrist. George screamed. He staggered backward, screaming in the empty house, screaming against the sound of the wind reaving the eaves, screaming against the sound of the house's creaking joints. He backed away, pulling Grandma's body askew under the coverlet, and the hand thudded back down, twisting, turning, snatching at the air, and then relaxing to limpness again. "I'm all right. It was nothing. It was nothing but a reflex." George nodded in perfect understanding, and then he remembered again how her hand had turned, clutching his. And he shrieked. His eyes bulged in their sockets. His hair stood out perfectly on end in a cone. His heart was a runaway stamping press in his chest. The world tilted crazily, came back to the level, and then just went on moving until it was tilted the other way. Every time rational thought started to come back, panic goosed him again. He whirled, wanting only to get out of the room to some other room, or even 3 or 4 miles down the road, if that was what it took, where he could get all of this under control. So he whirled and ran full tilt into the wall, missing the open doorway by a good 2 feet. He rebounded and fell to the floor, his head singing with a sharp cutting pain that sliced keenly through the panic. He touched his nose, and his hand came back bloody. Fresh drops spotted his shirt. He scrambled to his feet and looked around wildly. The hand dangled against the floor as it had before. But Grandma's body was not askew. It also was as it had been. He had imagined the whole thing. He had come into the room, and all the rest of it had been no more than a mind movie. No. But the pain had cleared his head. Dead people didn't grab your wrist. Dead was dead. When you were dead, they could use you for a hat rack, or stuff you in a tractor tire and roll you downhill, or etc., etc., etc. When you were dead, you might be acted upon by, say, little boys trying to put dead dangling hands back into bed. But your days of acting upon, so to speak, were over. Unless you're a witch. Unless you pick your time to die when no one's around but one little kid. Because it's best that way. You can what? Nothing. It was stupid. He had imagined the whole thing because he'd been scared, and that was all there was to it. He wiped his nose with his forearm and winced at the pain. There was a bloody smear on the skin of his inner forearm. He wasn't going to go near her again, that was all. Reality or hallucination, he wasn't going to mess with Grandma. The bright flare of panic was gone, but he was still miserably scared, near tears, shaky at the sight of his own blood, only wanting his mother to come home and take charge. George backed out of the room, through the entry, and into the kitchen. He drew a long, shuddery breath and let it out. He wanted a wet rag for his nose, and suddenly he felt like he was going to vomit. He went over to the sink and ran cold water. He bent and got a rag from the basin under the sink, a piece of one of Grandma's old diapers, and ran it under the cold tap, snuffling up blood as he did so. He soaked the old, soft, cotton diaper square until his hand was numb, then turned off the tap and wrung it out. He was putting it to his nose when her voice spoke from the other room.
"Come here, boy,"
Grandma called in a dead, buzzing voice.
"Come in here. Grandma wants to hug you."
George tried to scream, and no sound came out. No sound at all. But there were sounds in the other room. Sounds that he heard when Mom was in there, giving Grandma her bed bath, lifting her bulk, dropping it, turning it, dropping it again. Only those sounds now seemed to have a slightly different and yet utterly specific meaning. It sounded as though Grandma was trying to get out of bed.
Boy, come in here, boy. Right now. Step to it.
With horror, he saw that his feet were answering that command. He told them to stop, and they just went on. Left foot, right foot, hay foot, straw foot, over the linoleum. His brain was a terrified prisoner inside his body, a hostage in a tower.
She is a witch. She's a witch, and she's having one of her bad spells. Oh, yeah, it's a spell, all right, and it's bad. It's really bad. Oh, God, oh, Jesus, help me, help me, help me.
George walked across the kitchen and through the entryway and into Grandma's room. And yes, she hadn't just tried to get out of bed. She was out. She was sitting in the white vinyl chair where she hadn't sat for 4 years, since she got too heavy to walk and too senile to know where she was anyway. But Grandma didn't look senile now. Her face was sagging and doughy, but the senility was gone. If it had ever really been there at all, and not just a mask she wore to lull small boys and tired, husbandless women. Now Grandma's face gleamed with fell intelligence. It gleamed like an old stinking wax candle. Her eyes drooped in her face, lackluster and dead. Her chest was not moving. Her nightie had pulled up, exposing elephantine thighs. The coverlet of her deathbed was thrown back. Grandma held her huge arms out to him.
I want to hug you, Georgie, that flat and buzzing dead voice said. Don't be a scared old crybaby. Let your grandma hug you.
George cringed back, trying to resist that almost insurmountable pull. Outside, the wind shrieked and roared. George's face was long and twisted with the extremity of his fright, the face of a woodcut caught and shut up in an ancient book. George began to walk toward her. He couldn't help himself, step by dragging step toward those outstretched arms. He would show Buddy that he wasn't scared of Grandma either. He would go to Grandma and be hugged, because he wasn't a crybaby fraidy cat. He would go to Grandma now. He was almost within the circle of her arms when the window to his left crashed inward, and suddenly a wind-blown branch was in the room with them, autumn leaves still clinging to it. The river of wind flooded the room, blowing over Grandma's pictures, whipping her nightgown and her hair. Now George could scream. He stumbled backward out of her grip, and Grandma made a cheated, hissing sound, her lips pulling back over smooth old gums, her thick, wrinkled hands clapped uselessly together on moving air. George's feet tangled together and he fell down. Grandma began to rise from the white vinyl chair, a tottering pile of flesh. She began to stagger toward him. George found he couldn't get up. The strength had deserted his legs. He began to crawl backward, whimpering. Grandma came on, slowly but relentlessly, dead and yet alive. And suddenly George understood what the hug would mean. The puzzle was complete in his mind, and somehow he found his feet just as Grandma's hand closed on his shirt. It ripped up the side, and for one moment he felt her cold flesh against his skin before fleeing into the kitchen again. He would run into the night, anything other than being hugged by the witch, his grandma, because when his mother came back, she would find Grandma dead and George alive. Oh, yes. But George would have developed a sudden taste for herbal tea. He looked back over his shoulder and saw Grandma's grotesque, misshapen shadow rising on the wall as she came through the entryway. And at that moment, the telephone rang, shrilly and stridently. George seized it without even thinking and screamed into it, screamed for someone to come, to please come. He screamed these things silently. Not a sound escaped his locked throat. Grandma tottered into the kitchen in her pink nightie. Her whitish-yellow hair blew wildly around her face, and one of her horn combs hung askew against her wrinkled neck. Grandma was grinning.
"Ruth?"
It was Aunt Flo's voice, almost lost in the whistling wind tunnel of a bad long-distance connection.
"Ruth, are you there?"
It was Aunt Flo in Minnesota, over 2,000 miles away.
"Help me!"
George screamed into the phone, and what came out was a tiny hissing whistle, as if he had blown into a harmonica full of dead reeds. Grandma tottered across the linoleum, holding her arms out for him. Her hands snapped shut, and then open, and then shut again. Grandma wanted her hug. She had been waiting for that hug for 5 years.
"Ruth, can you hear me? It's been storming here. It just started, and I got scared. Ruth, I can't hear you."
"Grandma,"
George moaned into the phone. Now she was almost upon him.
"George?"
Aunt Flo's voice suddenly sharpened, became almost a shriek.
"George, is that you?"
He began to back away from Grandma and suddenly realized that he had stupidly backed away from the door and into the corner formed by the kitchen cabinets and the sink. The horror was complete. As her shadow fell over him, the paralysis broke, and he screamed into the phone, screamed it over and over again,
"Grandma! Grandma! Grandma!"
Grandma's cold hands touched his throat. Her muddy, ancient eyes locked on his, draining his will. Faintly, dimly, as if across many years as well as many miles, he heard Aunt Flo say,
"Tell her to lie down, George. Tell her to lie down and be still. Tell her she must do it in your name and the name of her father. The name of her taken father is Hastur. His name is power in her ear, George. Tell her lie down in the name of Hastur. Tell her."
The old wrinkled hand tore the telephone from George's nerveless grip. There was a taut pop as the cord pulled out of the phone. George collapsed in the corner, and Grandma bent down, a huge heap of flesh above him, blotting out the light. George screamed,
"Lie down! Be still! Hastur's name! Hastur, lie down! Be still!"
Her hands closed around his neck.
"You gotta do it! Aunt Flo said you did! In my name! In your father's name! Lie down! Be still!"
And squeezed. When the lights finally splashed into the driveway an hour later, George was sitting at the table in front of his unread history book. He got up and walked to the back door and opened it. To his left, the prince's phone hung in its cradle, its useless cord looped around it. His mother came in, a leaf clinging to the collar of her coat.
"Such a wind," she said. "Was everything all..." "George? George, what happened?"
The blood fell from Mom's face in a single shocked rush, turning her a horrible clown white.
"Grandma," he said. "Grandma died. Grandma died, Mommy."
And he began to cry. She swept him into her arms and then staggered back against the wall, as if this act of hugging had robbed the last of her strength.
Did anything happen?" she asked. "George, did anything else happen?" "The wind knocked a tree branch through her window," George said.
She pushed him away, looked at his shocked, slack face for a moment, and then stumbled into Grandma's room. She was in there for perhaps 4 minutes. When she came back, she was holding a red tatter of cloth. It was a bit of George's shirt.
"I took this out of her hand,"
Mom whispered.
"I don't want to talk about it," George said. "Call Aunt Flo if you want. I'm tired. I want to go to bed."
She made as if to stop him, but didn't. He went up to the room he shared with Buddy and opened the hot air register so he could hear what his mother did next. She wasn't going to talk to Aunt Flo. Not tonight, because the telephone cord had pulled out. Not tomorrow, because shortly before Mom had come home, George had spoken a short series of words, some of them bastardized Latin, some only pre-Druidic grunts, and over 2,000 miles away, Aunt Flo had dropped dead of a massive brain hemorrhage. It was amazing how those words came back, how everything came back. George undressed and lay down naked on his bed. He put his hands behind his head and looked up into the darkness. Slowly, slowly, a sunken and rather horrible grin surfaced on his face. Things were going to be different around here from now on. Very different. Buddy, for instance. George could hardly wait until Buddy came home from the hospital and started in with the spoon torture of the heathen Chinee, or an Indian rope burn, or something like that. George supposed he would have to let Buddy get away with it, at least in the daytime when people could see. But when night came, and they were alone in this room, in the dark, with the door closed, George began to laugh soundlessly. As Buddy always said, it was going to be a classic.
The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet. Read by Michael C. Hall.
The barbecue was over. It had been a good one. Drinks, charcoal T-bones, rare, a green salad, and Meg's special dressing. They had started at 5. Now it was 8:30 and almost dusk. The time when a big party is just starting to get rowdy. But they weren't a big party. They were just the 5 of them. The agent and his wife, the celebrated young writer and his wife, and the magazine editor, who was in his early 60s and looked older. The editor stuck to Fresca. The agent had told the young writer before the editor arrived that there had once been a drinking problem there. It was gone now, and so was the editor's wife, which was why they were 5 instead of 6. Instead of getting rowdy, an introspective mood fell over them as it started to get dark in the young writer's backyard, which fronted the lake. The young writer's first novel had been well reviewed and had sold a lot of copies. He was a lucky young man, and to his credit, he knew it. The conversation had turned with playful gruesomeness from the young writer's early success to other writers who had made their marks early and had then committed suicide. Ross Lockridge was touched upon, and Tom Hagen. The agent's wife mentioned Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton, and the young writer said that he didn't think Plath qualified as a successful writer. She had not committed suicide because of success, he said. She had gained success because she had committed suicide. The agent smiled.
"Please, couldn't we talk about something else?" the young writer's wife asked a little nervously.
Ignoring her, the agent said, "And madness. There have been those who have gone mad because of success." The agent had the mild but nonetheless rolling tones of an actor offstage. The writer's wife was about to protest again. She knew that her husband not only liked to talk about these things so he could joke about them, and he wanted to joke about them because he thought about them too much, when the magazine editor spoke up. What he said was so odd she forgot to protest. "Madness is a flexible bullet." The agent's wife looked startled. The young writer leaned forward quizzically. He said,
"That sounds familiar."
"Sure," the editor said. "That phrase, the image, flexible bullet, is Marianne Moore's. She used it to describe some car or other. I've always thought it described the condition of madness very well. Madness is a kind of mental suicide. Don't the doctors say now that the only way to truly measure death is by the death of the mind? Madness is a kind of flexible bullet to the brain." The young writer's wife hopped up.
"Anybody want another drink?"
She had no takers.
"Well, I do, if we're going to talk about this," she said, and went off to make herself one.
The editor said, "I had a story submitted to me once, when I was working over at Logan's. Of course, it's gone the way of Collier's and the Saturday Evening Post now, but we outlasted both of them." He said this with a trace of pride. "We publish 36 short stories a year, or more, and every year 4 or 5 of them would be in somebody's collection of the year's best. And people read them. Anyway, the name of this story was The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet, and it was written by a man named Reg Thorpe, a young man about this young man's age, and about as successful."
"He wrote Underworld Figures, didn't he?"
the agent's wife asked. "Yes, amazing track record for a first novel. Great reviews, lovely sales in hardcover and paperback, Literary Guild, everything. Even the movie was pretty good, although not as good as the book, nowhere near."
"I loved that book,"
the author's wife said, lured back into the conversation against her better judgment. She had the surprised, pleased look of someone who just recalled something which has been out of mind for too long.
"Has he written anything since then? I read Underworld Figures back in college, and that was, well, too long ago to think about."
"You haven't aged a day since then," the agent's wife said warmly, although privately she thought the young writer's wife was wearing a too small halter and a too tight pair of shorts. "No, he hasn't written anything since then," the editor said, "except for this one short story I was telling you about. He killed himself. Went crazy and killed himself."
"Oh,"
the young writer's wife said limply. "Back to that."
"Was the short story published?"
the young writer asked. "No, but not because the author went crazy and killed himself. It never got into print because the editor went crazy and almost killed himself." The agent suddenly got up to freshen his own drink, which hardly needed freshening. He knew that the editor had had a nervous breakdown in the summer of 1969, not long before Logan's had drowned in a sea of red ink. "I was the editor," the editor informed the rest of them. "In a sense, we went crazy together, Reg Thorpe and I. Even though I was in New York, he was out in Omaha, and we never even met. His book had been out about 6 months, and he had moved out there to get his head together, as the phrase was then. and I happen to know this side of the story because I see his wife occasionally when she's in New York. She paints, and quite well. She's a lucky girl. He almost took her with him. The agent came back and sat down. "I'm starting to remember some of this now," he said. "It wasn't just his wife, was it? He shot a couple of other people, one of them a kid." "That's right," the editor said. "It was the kid that finally set him off."
"The kid set him off?" the agent's wife asked. "What do you mean?"
But the editor's face said he would not be drawn. He would talk, but not be questioned. "I know my side of the story because I lived it," the magazine editor said. "I'm lucky, too, damned lucky. It's an interesting thing about those who try to kill themselves by pointing a gun at their heads and pulling the trigger. You'd think it would be the foolproof method, better than pills or slashing the wrists, but it isn't. When you shoot yourself in the head, you just can't tell what's going to happen. The slug may ricochet off the skull and kill someone else. It may follow the skull's curve all the way around and come out on the other side. It may lodge in the brain and blind you and leave you alive. One man may shoot himself in the forehead with a .38 and wake up in the hospital. Another may shoot himself in the forehead with a .22 and wake up in hell, if there is such a place. I tend to believe it's here on Earth, possibly in New Jersey." The writer's wife laughed rather shrilly. "The only foolproof suicide method is to step off a very high building, and that's a way out that only the extraordinarily dedicated ever take. So damn messy, isn't it? But my point is simply this. When you shoot yourself with a flexible bullet, you really don't know what the outcome is going to be. In my case, I went off a bridge and woke up on a trash-littered embankment with a trucker whapping me on the back and pumping my arms up and down like he had only 24 hours to get in shape and he had mistaken me for a rowing machine. For Reg, the bullet was lethal. But I'm telling you a story I have no idea if you want to hear." He looked around at them questioningly in the gathering gloom. The agent and the agent's wife glanced at each other uncertainly, and the writer's wife was about to say she thought they'd had enough gloomy talk when her husband said, "I'd like to hear it, if you don't mind telling it for personal reasons, I mean." "I never have told it," the editor said, "but not for personal reasons. Perhaps I never had the correct listeners." "Then tell away," the writer said.
"Paul," his wife put her hand on his shoulder, "don't you think..."
"Not now, Meg," the editor said. "The story came in over the transom, and at that time, Logan's no longer read unsolicited scripts. When they came in, a girl would just put them into return envelopes with a note that said, 'Due to increasing costs and the increasing inability of the editorial staff to cope with a steadily increasing number of submissions, Logan's no longer reads unsolicited manuscripts. We wish you the best of luck in placing your work elsewhere.' Isn't that a lovely bunch of gobbledygook? It's not easy to use the word increasing 3 times in one sentence, but they did it. And if there was no return postage, the story went into the wastebasket," the writer said. "Right?"
"Oh, absolutely. No pity in the naked city."
An odd expression of unease flitted across the writer's face. It was the expression of a man who is in a tiger pit, where dozens of better men have been clawed to pieces. So far, this man hasn't seen a single tiger, but he has a feeling that they are there, and that their claws are still sharp.
"Anyway," the editor said, taking out his cigarette case, "this story came in, and the girl in the mailroom took it out, paper-clipped the form rejection to the first page, and was getting ready to put it in the return envelope when she glanced at the author's name. Well, she had read Underworld Figures. That fall, everybody had read it, or was reading it, or was on the library waiting list, or checking the drugstore racks for the paperback."
The writer's wife, who had seen the momentary unease on her husband's face, took his hand. He smiled at her. The editor snapped gold Ronson to his cigarette, and in the growing dark they could all see how haggard his face was. The loose crocodile skin patches under the eyes, the runneled cheeks, the old man's jut of chin emerging out of that late middle-aged face like the prow of a ship. That ship, the writer thought, is called old age. No one particularly wants to cruise on it, but the staterooms are full. The gang holds too, for that matter. The lighter winked out, and the editor puffed his cigarette meditatively. The girl in the mailroom, who read that story and passed it on instead of sending it back, is now a full editor at G.P. Putnam's Sons. Her name doesn't matter. What matters is that on the great graph of life, this girl's vector crossed Reg Thorpe's in the mailroom of Logan's magazine. Hers was going up, and his was going down. She sent the story to her boss, and her boss sent it to me. I read it and loved it. It was really too long, but I could see where he could pare 500 words off it with no sweat, and that would be plenty. What was it about? The writer asked. You shouldn't even have to ask, the editor said. It fits so beautifully into the total context. About going crazy? Yes, indeed. What's the first thing they teach you in your first college creative writing course? Write about what you know. Reg Thorpe knew about going crazy because he was engaged in going there. The story probably appealed to me because I was also going there. Now, you could say, if you were an editor, that the one thing the American reading public doesn't need foisted on them is another story about going mad stylishly in America, subtopic A, nobody talks to each other anymore. A popular theme in 20th century literature. All the greats have taken a hack at it, and all the hacks have taken an axe to it. But this story was funny. I mean, it was really hilarious. I hadn't read anything like it before, and I haven't since. The closest would be some of F. Scott Fitzgerald's stories and Gatsby. The fellow in Thorpe's story was going crazy, but he was doing it in a very funny way. He kept grinning, and there were a couple of places in this story. The place where the hero dumps the lime jello on the fat girl's head is the best, where you laugh right out loud. But they're jittery laughs, you know? You laugh, and then you want to look over your shoulder to see what heard you. The opposing lines of tension in that story were really extraordinary. The more you laughed, the more nervous you got. And the more nervous you got, the more you laughed. Right up to the point where the hero goes home from the party given in his honor and kills his wife and baby daughter. What's the plot? The agent asked. No, the editor said, that doesn't matter. It was just a story about a young man gradually losing his struggle to cope with success. It's better left vague. A detailed plot synopsis would only be boring. They always are. Anyway, I wrote him a letter. It said this. Dear Reg Thorpe, I've just read The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet, and I think it's great. I'd like to publish it in Logan's early next year, if that fits. Does $800 sound okay? Payment on acceptance, more or less. New paragraph. The editor indented the evening air with his cigarette. The story runs a little long, and I'd like you to shorten it by about 500 words, if you could. I would settle for a 200-word cut, if it comes to that. We can always drop a cartoon. Paragraph. Call if you want. My signature. And off the letter went to Omaha.
And you remember it word for word like that?
The writer's wife asked.
I kept all the correspondence in a special file, the editor said. His letters, carbons of mine back, there was quite a stack of it by the end, including 3 or 4 pieces of correspondence from Jane Thorpe, his wife. I've read the file over quite often. No good, of course. Trying to understand the flexible bullet is like trying to understand how a Mobius strip can have only one side. That's just the way things are in this best of all possible worlds. Yes, I know it all word for word, or almost. Some people have the Declaration of Independence by heart.
Betty called you the next day, the agent said, grinning. Collect.
No, he didn't call. Shortly after Underworld Figures, Thorpe stopped using the telephone altogether. His wife told me that. When they moved to Omaha from New York, they didn't even have a phone put in the new house. He had decided, you see, that the telephone system didn't really run on electricity, but on radium. He thought it was one of the 2 or 3 best-kept secrets in the history of the modern world. He claimed to his wife that all the radium was responsible for the growing cancer rate.
not cigarettes or automobile emissions or industrial pollution. Each telephone had a small radium crystal in the handset, and every time you used the phone, you shot your head full of radiation.
Yeah, he was crazy, the writer said, and they all laughed.
He wrote instead, the editor said, flicking his cigarette in the direction of the lake. His letter said this: Dear Henry Wilson, or just Henry, if I may, your letter was both exciting and gratifying. My wife was, if anything, more pleased than I. The money is fine, although in all honesty, I must say that the idea of being published in Logan's at all seems like more than adequate compensation, but I'll take it, I'll take it. I've looked over your cuts, and they seem fine. I think they'll improve the story as well as clear space for those cartoons. All best wishes, Reg Thorpe. Under his signature was a funny little drawing, more like a doodle. An eye in a pyramid, like the one on the back of the dollar bill. But instead of Novus Ordo Seclorum on the banner beneath, there were these words: Fornit sum fornus.
Either Latin or Groucho Marx, the agent's wife said.
Just part of Reg Thorpe's growing eccentricity, the editor said. His wife told me that Reg had come to believe in little people, sort of like elves or fairies. The Fornits. They were luck elves, and he thought one of them lived in his typewriter.
Oh, my lord, the writer's wife said.
According to Thorpe, each Fornit has a small device, like a flit gun, full of good luck dust, I guess you'd call it. And the good luck dust is called Fornus, the writer finished. He was grinning broadly. Yes, and his wife thought it was quite funny, too, at first. In fact, she thought at first Thorpe had conceived the Fornits 2 years before while he was drafting Underworld Figures, that it was just Reg having her on. And maybe at first he was. It seems to have progressed from a whimsy to a superstition to an outright belief. It was a flexible fantasy, but hard in the end. Very hard. They were all silent. The grins had faded. The Fornits had their funny side, the editor said. Thorpe's typewriter started going to the shop a lot near the end of their stay in New York, and it was even a more frequent thing when they moved to Omaha. He had a loaner while it was being fixed for the first time out there. The dealership manager called a few days after Reg got his own machine back to tell him he was going to send a bill for cleaning the loaner as well as Thorpe's own machine.
What was the trouble? The agent's wife asked.
I think I know, the writer's wife said. It was full of food, the editor said. Tiny bits of cake and cookies. There was peanut butter smeared on the platens of the keys themselves. Reg was feeding the Fornit in his typewriter. He also fed the loner, on the off chance that the Fornit had made the switch.
Boy, the writer said.
I knew none of these things, you understand. For the nonce, I wrote back to him and told him how pleased I was. My secretary typed the letter and brought it in for my signature, and then she had to go out for something. I signed it, and she wasn't back. And then, for no real reason at all, I put the same doodle below my name. Pyramid, eye, and Fornit sum fornus. Crazy. The secretary saw it and asked me if I wanted it sent out that way. I shrugged and told her to go ahead. 2 days later, Jane Thorpe called me. She told me that my letter had excited Reg a great deal. Reg thought he had found a kindred soul, someone else who knew about the Fornits. You see what a crazy situation it was getting to be? As far as I knew at that point, a Fornit could have been anything from a left-handed monkey wrench to a Polish steak knife. Ditto Fornus. I explained to Jane that I had merely copied Reg's own design. She wanted to know why. I slipped the question, although the answer would have been because I was very drunk when I signed the letter. He paused, and an uncomfortable silence fell on the back lawn area. People looked at the sky, the lake, the trees, although they were no more interesting now than they had been a minute or two before. I had been drinking all my adult life,
and it's impossible for me to say when it began to get out of control. In the professional sense, I was on top of the bottle until nearly the very end. I would begin drinking at lunch and come back to the office el blado. I functioned perfectly well there, however. It was the drinks after work, first on the train, then at home, that pushed me over the functional point. My wife and I had been having problems that were unrelated to the drinking, but the drinking made the other problems worse. For a long time, she had been preparing to leave, and a week before the Reg Thorpe story came in, she did it. I was trying to deal with that when the Thorpe story came in. I was drinking too much, and to top it all off, I was having, well, I guess now it's fashionable to call it a midlife crisis. All I knew at the time was that I was as depressed about my professional life as I was about my personal one. I was coming to grips, or trying to, with a growing feeling that editing mass-market stories that would end up being read by nervous dental patients, housewives at lunchtime, and an occasional bored college student was not exactly a noble occupation. I was coming to grips, again trying to, all of us at Logan's were at that time, with the idea that in another 6 months, or 10 or 14, there might not be any Logan's. Into this dull, autumnal landscape of middle-aged angst comes a very good story by a very good writer, a funny, energetic look at the mechanics of going crazy. It was like a bright ray of sun. I know it sounds strange to say that about a story that ends with the protagonist killing his wife and infant child, but you ask any editor what real joy is, and he'll tell you it's the great story or novel you didn't expect, landing on your desk like a big Christmas present. Look, you all know that Shirley Jackson story, The Lottery. It ends on one of the most downbeat notes you can imagine. I mean, they take a nice lady out and stone her to death. Her son and daughter participate in her murder, for Christ's sake. But it was a great piece of storytelling, and I bet the editor at The New Yorker who read the story first went home that night whistling. What I'm trying to say is the Thorpe story was the best thing in my life right then. The one good thing. And from what his wife told me on the phone that day, my acceptance of that story was the one good thing that had happened to him lately. The author-editor relationship is always mutual parasitism, but in the case of Reg and me, that parasitism was heightened to an unnatural degree.
Let's go back to Jane Thorpe, the writer's wife said.
Yes, I did sort of leave her on a sidetrack, didn't I? She was angry about the Fornet business, at first. I told her I had simply doodled that eye and pyramid symbol under my signature with no knowledge of what it might be and apologized for whatever I'd done. She got over her anger and spilled everything to me. She'd been getting more and more anxious, and she had no one at all to talk to. Her folks were dead, and all her friends were back in New York. Reg wouldn't allow anyone at all in the house. They were tax people, he said, or FBI, or CIA. Not long after they moved to Omaha, a little girl came to the door selling Girl Scout cookies. Reg yelled at her, told her to get the hell out. He knew why she was there, and so on. Jane tried to reason with him. She pointed out that the girl had only been 10 years old. Reg told her that the tax people had no souls, no consciences. And besides, he said, the little girl might have been an android. Androids wouldn't be subject to the child labor laws. He wouldn't put it past the tax people to send an android Girl Scout full of radium crystals to find out if he was keeping any secrets, and to shoot him full of cancer rays in the meantime.
Good Lord, the agent's wife said.
She'd been waiting for a friendly voice, and mine was the first. I got the Girl Scout story. I found out about the care and feeding of Fornets, about Fornus, about how Reg refused to use a telephone. She was talking to me from a pay booth in a drugstore 5 blocks over. She told me that she was afraid it wasn't really taxmen or FBI or CIA Reg was worried about. She thought he was really afraid that they, some hulking anonymous group that hated Reg, was jealous of Reg, would stop at nothing to get Reg, had found out about his Fornet and wanted to kill it. If the Fornet was dead, there would be no more novels, no more short stories, nothing. You see? The essence of insanity. They were out to get him. In the end, not even the IRS, which had given him the very devil of a time over the income underworld figures generated, would serve as the boogeyman. In the end, it was just they. The perfect paranoid fantasy. They wanted to kill his Fornet.
"My God, what did you say to her?" the agent asked.
"I tried to reassure her," the editor said. "There I was, freshly returned from a 5-martini lunch, talking to this terrified woman who was standing in a drugstore phone booth in Omaha, trying to tell her it was all right, not to worry that her husband believed that the phones were full of radium crystals, that a bunch of anonymous people were sending android Girl Scouts to get the goods on him. Not to worry that her husband had disconnected his talent from his mentality to such a degree that he could believe there was an elf living in his typewriter. I don't believe I was very convincing. She asked me, no, begged me, to work with Reg on his story, to see that it got published. She did everything but come out and say, the flexible bullet was Reg's last contact to what we laughingly call reality. I asked her what I should do if Reg mentioned Fornets again. Humor him, she said. Her exact words, humor him. And then she hung up. There was a letter in the mail from Reg the next day, 5 pages, typed, single-spaced. The first paragraph was all about the story. The second draft was getting on well, he said. He thought he would be able to shave 700 words from the original 10,500, bringing the final down to a tight 9,008. The rest of the letter was about Fornets and Fornus, his own observations and questions, dozens of questions. Observations? The writer leaned forward. He was actually seeing them then? No, the editor said. Not seeing them in an actual sense, but in another way, I suppose he was. You know, astronomers knew Pluto was there long before they had a telescope powerful enough to see it. They knew all about it by studying the planet Neptune's orbit. Reg was observing the Fornets in that way. They liked to eat at night, he said. Had I noticed that? He fed them at all hours of the day, but he noticed that most of it disappeared after 8 p.m. Hallucination? The writer asked. No, the editor said. His wife simply cleared as much of the food out of the typewriter as she could when Reg went out for his evening walk. And he went out every evening at 9 o'clock. I'd say she had quite a nerve getting after you, the agent grunted. He shifted his large bulk in the lawn chair. She was feeding the man's fantasy herself. You don't understand why she called and why she was so upset, the editor said quietly. He looked at the writer's wife. But I'll bet you do, Meg. Maybe, she said and gave her husband an uncomfortable sideways look. She wasn't mad because you were feeding his fantasy. She was afraid you might upset it. Bravo. The editor lit a fresh cigarette. And she removed the food for the same reason. If the food continued to accumulate in the typewriter, Reg would make the logical assumption, proceeding directly from his own decidedly illogical premise, namely that his Fornet had either died or left, hence no more Fornus, hence no more writing, hence... The editor let the word drift away on cigarette smoke and then resumed. He thought that Fornets were probably nocturnal. They didn't like loud noises. He had noticed that he hadn't been able to write on mornings after noisy parties. They hated the TV, they hated free electricity, they hated radium. Reg had sold their TV to Goodwill for $20, he said, and his wristwatch with the radium dial was long gone. Then the questions. How did I know about Fornets? Was it possible that I had one in residence? If so, what did I think about this, this, and that? I don't need to be more specific, I think. If you've ever gotten a dog of a particular breed and can recollect the questions you asked about its care and feeding, you'll know most of the questions Reg asked me. One little doodle below my signature was all it took to open Pandora's box. What did you write back? The agent asked.
the editor said slowly.
That's where the trouble really began, for both of us. Jane had said, humor him, so that's what I did. Unfortunately, I rather overdid it. I answered his letter at home, and I was very drunk. The apartment seemed much too empty. It had a stale smell, cigarette smoke, not enough airing. Things were going to seed with Sandra gone. The drop cloth on the couch all wrinkled, dirty dishes in the sink, that sort of thing. The middle-aged man unprepared for domesticity. I sat there with a sheet of my personal stationery rolled into the typewriter, and I thought, I need a Fornit. In fact, I need a dozen of them to dust this damn lonely house with Fornis from end to end. In that instant, I was drunk enough to envy Reg Thorpe his delusion. I said I had a Fornit, of course. I told Reg that mine was remarkably similar to his in its characteristics. Nocturnal, hated loud noises, but seemed to enjoy Bach and Brahms. I often did my best work after an evening of listening to them, I said. I had found my Fornit had a decided taste for Kirchner's bologna. Had Reg ever tried it? I simply left little scraps of it near the scripto I always carried, my editorial blue pencil, if you like. And it was almost always gone in the morning, unless, as Reg said, it had been noisy the night before. I told him I was glad to know about radium, even though I didn't have a glow-in-the-dark wristwatch. I told him my Fornit had been with me since college. I got so carried away with my own invention that I wrote nearly 6 pages. At the end, I added a paragraph about the story, a very perfunctory thing, and signed it.
And below your signature? The agent's wife asked.
Sure. Fornit. Some Fornis.
He paused.
You can't see it in the dark, but I'm blushing. I was so goddamn drunk, so goddamn smug. I might have had second thoughts in the cold light of dawn, but by then it was too late.
You'd mailed it the night before, the writer murmured.
So I did. And then for a week and a half I held my breath and waited. One day the manuscript came in, addressed to me, no covering letter. The cuts were as we had discussed them, and I thought that the story was letter perfect. But the manuscript was, well, I put it in my briefcase, took it home, and retyped it myself. It was covered with weird yellow stains.
I thought, urine?
The agent's wife asked. Yes, that's what I thought. But it wasn't. And when I got home, there was a letter in my mailbox from Reg. 10 pages this time. In the course of the letter, the yellow stains were accounted for. He hadn't been able to find Kirchner's bologna, so he'd tried Jordan's. He said they loved it, especially with mustard. I had been quite sober that day. But his letter, combined with those pitiful mustard stains ground right into the pages of his manuscript, sent me directly to the liquor cabinet. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Go directly to drunk.
What else did the letter say? The agent's wife asked. She had grown more and more fascinated with the tale, and was now leaning over her not inconsiderable belly, in a posture that reminded the writer's wife of Snoopy, standing on his doghouse and pretending to be a vulture.
Only 2 lines about the story this time, all credit thrown to the Fornit, and to me. The bologna had really been a fantastic idea. Rackney loved it, and as a consequence—
Rackney? The author asked.
That was the Fornit's name, the editor said. Rackney. As a consequence of the baloney, Rackney had really gotten behind in the rewrite. The rest of the letter was a paranoid chant. You have never seen such stuff in your life.
Reg and Rackney, a marriage made in heaven, the writer's wife said and giggled nervously.
Oh, not at all, the editor said. Theirs was a working relationship, and Rackney was male.
Well, tell us about the letter.
That's one I don't have by heart. It's just as well for you that I don't. Even abnormality grows tiresome after a while. The mailman was CIA. The paperboy was FBI. Reg had seen a silenced revolver in his sack of papers. The people next door were spies of some sort. They had surveillance equipment in their van. He no longer dared to go down to the corner store for supplies because the proprietor was an android.
He had suspected it before, he said, but now he was sure. He had seen the wires crisscrossing under the man's scalp, where he was beginning to go bald. And the radium